The following speech, titled Evaluation of the American Soldier in Combat, was presented by Major W.E. Mayer at the Conference of Professors of Air Science at Maxwell Air Force Base, November 27, 1956. The opinions expressed are those of Major Mayer and do not necessarily represent the opinion of the United States Army. Major Mayer was introduced by Brigadier General T.C. Rogers, Commandant of Air Force ROTC. In his remarks, General Rogers pointed out that Major Mayer has extensive experience in both civilian and military psychiatry and was, as psychiatrist with the 1st Marine Division in Korea, perhaps the only psychiatrist in the United States who has actually been in combat. He transferred to the Army in 1952 and was assigned to the Special Medical Intelligence Project on Korean Prisoners of War. His talk is based in part on his personal interviews of most of the American prisoners we got back out of Korea.
General Rogers, General Wallace, my fellow school teachers, I'm conscious of a very great privilege in being here, and I say that in all earnestness, for the simple reason that I think you people have the most important job in the Air Force. And as you know, I'm not here recruiting or any such thing. However, we've become concerned in the Army, as I think many of you have in your branch, with certain trends and tendencies among personnel, reflecting on the qualities of leadership and on this moral fiber that was at the basis of Dr. Wright's pyramid this morning. We've done a lot of studying on it, as have your own people. We've hired a great many intelligent civilian research groups to do more studying of it. And there's some indication that we're about as confused about personnel management and leadership and moral fiber and right and wrong as parents are confused about whether or not to spank their children. And that's about as seriously confused as you can be. I want to talk, as General Rogers said, about our findings with the Americans who were the first, really, large cross-section of American youth to live in a communist society for any period of time. There were altogether 7,000 such people, of whom we finally got back 4,000. And my comments will be restricted almost entirely to our findings on Army personnel. And I'll make this point a little more clear later on, but suffice it to say that our studies within the Army have obviously been centered around these people, and they constituted about 95% of the prisoners in Korea. I will describe briefly for you what happened to them in relation to a specific document, namely the Code of Conduct. This remarkable and rather curious document, as you know, has been in existence for a little over a year. It was thought important enough by the President that he announced it himself instead of leaving it to the Chiefs of Staff. It is a greatly maligned and greatly underestimated piece of work. It is probably the least understood military document that I have ever seen, judging by people's reaction to it, even intelligent and sophisticated, and I might say particularly sophisticated people's reactions to it. What I will actually present to you in a very abbreviated form this afternoon is a coverage, however superficial it might be at certain points, of the data that went into the construction of the Code of Conduct in the first place, the justification for the Code of Conduct. And I am hoping very sincerely that in hearing this version of what we know or what we think we know, you can make applications relative to this document in the critically important area of the junior officer with whom you deal and who you really prepare from the standpoint of attitudes, perhaps more importantly than any other one standpoint. I have a document which I would like to read for you by way of introduction. It's fairly brief. It's very much to the point. It was written by communists, but I'd like you to listen to it as in as detached and objective a way as possible. Most of it came from a message that was written by the chief of intelligence of the Chinese People's Volunteers in North Korea to the chief of intelligence of the Chinese People's Republic in Peking. And the message, the original one that we got intercepted, was entitled An Evaluation of American Soldiers. The text, literally translated, reads as follows. Based upon our observation of the American soldiers and their officers captured in this war for the liberation of Korea from capitalist imperialist aggression, some facts are evident. The American soldier has weak loyalties to his family, his community, his country, his religion, and to his fellow soldier. His concept of right and wrong is hazy. He is basically materialistic, and he is an opportunist. By himself, he feels insecure and frightened. He underestimates his own worth and his strength and his ability to survive. He is ignorant of social values, social conflicts, and tensions. There is little or no knowledge or understanding, even among American university graduates, of U.S. political history and philosophy, the federal, state, and community organizations, states and civil rights, freedoms, safeguards, and how these allegedly operate within his own decadent system. He is exceedingly insular and provincial, with little or no idea of the problems and the aims of what he contemptuously describes as foreigners and their countries. He has an unrealistic concept of America's eternal and inherent, rather than earned or proven, superiority and absolute military invincibility. He fails to appreciate the meaning of and the necessity for military organization or any form of discipline. Most often, he appears to feel that his military service is a hateful, unavoidable servitude to be tolerated as briefly as possible and then escaped from as rapidly as possible, or he is what they themselves call a peacetime soldier who sees it only as a soft and a safe job. Both of these types resent hardship and sacrifice of any description as if these things were unreasonable and unfair to them personally. Based upon the above facts about the imperialist United States aggressors, the re-education and indoctrination program for American prisoners proceeds as planned. And that's the end of the message. That's obviously a communist document. I do not present it as an endorsement of the document. I only present it for your consideration and because it contributes a good bit to the understanding of the approach that the communists used in their handling of Americans in Korea. There's been a great deal of tripe produced in this country and abroad about the nature of communist captivity and the nature of suffering in the communist world. I am not here to deny that suffering and torture and things like that exist within the communist system. I am here to make an observation, which is only an opinion, that we will never really be able to combat with great success what the communists attempt to do until we understand them on something more than an epithetical name-calling kind of a basis. And here in Korea was our first magnificent attempt really to understand them and to understand something about life in a communist society, not from the standpoint of horror stories and star chambers, but from the standpoint of what goes on to the average individual, if there is such a thing, who lives in a communist state. So we set to work to evaluate the Americans who came back. Unfortunately, most of the information given to the public and to the military has, for a variety of usually sincere, not always wise reasons, been presented from the standpoint of the old epithetical approach. And the stories that make the best printing and the best reading and sell the most editions of True Magazine are stories that emphasize the horrors, the degradations, and the brutality of the communists, all of which were true, but none of which gives a typical or really insightful picture of communist life. The communists had in their hands 7,000 Americans, enemy soldiers, behind their own lines in a small peninsula, which was just as hard to chase somebody in as it was to run away in. They had first and foremost the same objective with these people as they have within any communist society on earth, namely the physical control of those people. And it became clear as we did our study that this overwhelmingly was their principal objective. They had secondary objectives of great importance, particularly, most dramatically, the exploitation of Air Force representatives on the basis of charges of germ warfare. However, this still was secondary to the great need to handle the 7,000 recalcitrant Americans who in previous wars have had, and rightfully, the general reputation of being the most difficult prisoners to keep in any camp, any place. So they set about to do it, and they used a procedure which we find described by a great number of experts, real and self-appointed, under the general term of brainwashing. And brainwashing is a word that the government dislikes, frankly, and in a way I go along with this, because it can mean anything to anybody, from what you say to a girl out on a date to something that the communists attempt to do to their people. However, the word deserves a little attention. It's a magnificent psychological achievement in itself. It creates an aura of irresistibility, of magic, of something that happens to people's minds. And indeed, brainwashing, as it's generally accepted by those who seem to know the most about it, including one Edward Hunter, who originally introduced the word into the language, does include a fair proportion of strange things like the handling of Cardinal Menzenti and Otis and Vogler and some of Colonel Arnold's experiences and so on. However, brainwashing includes a great deal more. We found for the most part, for the great bulk of prisoners, brainwashing was a process of indoctrination and a very excellent one. It employed in a careful, systematic, and thoughtful way the same principles of psychology and psychiatry that we use, not only in treating patients, but in education. It used these in a more determined sense than we have attempted to apply our psychological principles socially. Social psychiatry is a new thing in this country. It's beginning to crop up in departments in medical schools. We're beginning to realize that there's more to this business of human beings and their feelings than just what comes out on the couch. There's something that goes on between people and among people in groups. The communists have, and they certainly haven't found ultimate truth about this, but they have devoted, evidently, a good deal of attention to the application of psychological principles in a way we consider backwards, in a way designed not to restore emotional equilibrium or help people to a better, more mature adjustment, basically to interfere with what we consider normal, adult, healthy relationships between people. And this, more than anything else, is brainwashing. Essentially, it's a weapon because it is the most effective, to date, control system, dictatorship-wise, that we've ever seen in operation. It's a peculiar kind of weapon, of course, in that it's being used right today. It's being used in differing degrees here in this country as well as abroad. It can be used on your friends as well as your enemies. It's particularly good for neutrals and determined neutralists like people in India and Indonesia. Its effectiveness, I think, can be judged pragmatically by a glance at the results of communist methods. In now 39 years since the October Revolution, they have taken over from scratch and now control one out of every three living human beings. And they control these people with more success, less apparent trouble, than anybody has ever controlled any really large number of people. Now, they have trouble, there's no question about it. They have trouble, beautiful trouble, in Hungary and in Poland and in East Germany. But the remarkable thing is that they've had so little in the 40 years that they've taken over and now control these 900 million people. Now, they've done this by the use of a good deal of fairly liberal bloodshed. I heard from a non-classified but intelligence source not long ago that we can, with absolute authority say that the Chinese alone have killed over 20 million out of the total that they've got in that country, which isn't perhaps a great percentage, but it's an awful lot of people. The fact remains, however, that any evaluation of the number of people so treated in the communist societies all over the earth still leave large groups of humans who have never been handled in this fashion, who've never been exiled to Siberia or beaten or tortured or even separated from their families, who show a remarkable degree of acquiescence to what the communists are doing. And we think this weapon has a good deal to do with it, this application of perfectly sound psychological principles. Now, we found, first of all, and this has been a point of great controversy for a variety of reasons, we found, first of all, that the weapon as it was employed in Korea on Americans did not, for the great majority, include any of the standard techniques which we expected and which we consciously and deliberately attempted to elicit for use in protests at an international political level. Thinking back, the average soldier in a bunker on the front lines in Korea pretty well expected that if he were caught by this diabolical Oriental enemy, he would surely have fingernails abused during his initial debriefing. He probably would be subjected to all kinds of exquisite Oriental abuses. Partly this is the legend that exists in our country about the Oriental, and partly it was based on realistic considerations of how many Japanese treated many Americans during the war, World War II. However, the Americans found for the great majority there was no such thing. There was no physical abuse that we can identify as ever being deliberate or systematic for about 99% of the total group of prisoners. There were no narcotics used on these people. We know the Chinese have a good deal to do with the international narcotic traffic. They didn't use magic, and by magic I include Pavlov's conditioned reflex, a process invented by a Russian for physiological experimentation, which is a very interesting one and which gives us some insight about learning in general. Certainly the conditioned reflex plays a part in certain aspects of human learning, but does not account for acceptance of abstract concepts on the part of a complicated human being operating in an even more complicated social environment. The reason I labor the point is because a number of, I think, competent psychologists in this country as well as abroad have said that the communists' great strength with people and their ability to communicate their ideas rests with the fact that they have perverted and magnified the Pavlovian conditioned reflex to where you can no more resist their political machinations than Pavlov's dogs can resist salivating, which is just plain hogwash. Finally, they didn't use any beautiful young females to lead these innocent young soldiers astray. The sex approach, which was attempted in some American universities by the Young Communist League in the 30s, has apparently gone by the board, along with legalized abortion and several other experiments in the people's democracy. What they did do to the majority of Americans, and please remember I'm restricting this discussion to the experiences of Army personnel, leaving out, at least for the time, the Air Force people who were held in solitary, some of whom in Manchuria, who were subjected to every known crude form of physical and mental abuse to try to get them to cooperate. I'm talking instead about the rest of the prisoners. For them, the procedure of brainwashing was a remarkably simple and deceptive kind of a thing. The procedure that actually was used on these people began, for most of them, about the time they were captured. It began, first of all, with a speech of welcome and introduction. The speech was given at collecting points, usually to groups of 10 or 15 or 20 American soldiers. After being often inadequately disarmed, they were gathered together, and then a young Chinese appeared, normally not in military dress, a Chinese who was young, who affected a friendly and conciliatory attitude, and who gave the following little speech, and I repeat it almost verbatim. He would say approximately, "We welcome you to the ranks of the people. We are happy and privileged to have liberated you from the imperialist Wall Street warmongers who started this war. We have nothing against you personally. We know you don't want to be here any more than we do. We are not going to abuse you. We are going instead to offer you a proposition, a deal, a fair shake. The deal is this. You cooperate with us physically. Don't get any ideas about our being your enemy. After all, we are really the people like you are. Listen to us. Let us present to you our side of the world picture today of what we think is really going on here in Korea and back in your homes and with the great masses of people you've never had a chance to learn about. And that's what we ask of you. In return for this, there'll be no slave camps, no work gangs, no road crews, no coal mines. We'll just simply give you a chance to learn the truth as we know the truth to be. And we're not even going to insist that you accept it. We ask only that you hear us out, which is only American fair play, and make up your own minds about what is true, and then as soon as the warmongers allow this senseless slaughter of innocent civilians to be ended, then we want you to go home to your own good homes and find families and tell them the truth as you understand the truth to be. Now, that's fair enough, and it's a lot different from having your fingernails pulled out. Right after this, they set about to isolate and segregate certain groups. They segregated, first of all colored troops, put them in separate camps. The U.S. Army had just officially ended segregation within the U.S. Army, all the branches of service, but these are Army people. The second group they segregated was what they called the poisonous individualists, which means anybody who showed any kind of leadership tendencies, anybody who had the audacity to assume that he could lead other men within this specially constructed social organization, was immediately dubbed a poisonous individualist or a hopeless reactionary, and was put off in what was called a reactionary camp, a camp more heavily guarded in general, less well fed, less intensively schooled, but still not particularly abusive by normal POW camp standards. Our first and most disturbing finding in general about the prisoners of war was the fact that it was only necessary to segregate one out of every 20 American fighting men. This includes officers, NCOs, and enlisted men, in order to deprive the other 95% of any form of effective leadership. Only one out of 20 Americans in this group, which I'd like to emphasize was not the bottom of the manpower barrel, only one in 20 apparently thought it worthwhile to try to act on the basis of organization, of taking command, or of responding to command. They then had a group of approximately 95% of the American soldiers leaderless. And with these people, they set about then with their applied group psychology, not very mysterious psychology at that, designed basically to do one thing and one thing only. Please remember that the major objective of the communist society is the physical control of the society, whether it's a group of POWs or a cell of the Communist Party in Montgomery or in New York City or in Peking. And for this purpose of physical control, the best possible military principle is the same one that's ancient and hallowed, and that is divide and conquer. And so they set out to divide these people in a most peculiar kind of a way. The way that they aimed at very much resembles the kind of thing that a patient says to the psychiatrist when he walks in under his own steam for treatment. I'm not now talking about very sick people. I'm talking about the great majority of psychiatric patients who are still able to function, who are still responsible citizens, but who are also upset and who feel finally that they need help. They come in and their complaints frequently, if not always to a certain extent, revolve around certain areas of human life. Their most common expression is, "Doctor, people don't understand me." And certainly you and I have felt this way. Secondly, they often report that they no longer communicate successfully or rewardingly, particularly with people who have been important to them. My wife and I, they say, don't have anything to talk about anymore. We don't seem to understand each other. I don't like the people I work with in the office, but I can't put my finger on why. I'm not happy in my job, but I don't know what I'd rather do. This is a very typical constellation for the psychiatric patient who walks in your office to present for you in some term or other. Now, this is exactly what we saw among returning prisoners of war. When we got a large number of them, about 500 in Tokyo, we put them on the open wards, the ambulatory wards in the Tokyo hospitals. A few of them were quite sick, but the great majority could walk, could move around, and were not restricted from a medical standpoint. Now, those of you who've ever walked on a ward in a military hospital holding ambulatory patients know that the ward has certain characteristics. One, it's noisy. Two, the noise is being produced usually by a small number of people because that's all the people that are ever on the ward. The others are at the Red Cross or chasing around downtown or anything that their ambulatory status will permit. The peculiar thing about these people was that you could walk on a ward in the Tokyo Army Hospital with maybe 50 POWs present, and all 50 would be on the ward, which is just unheard of. The second thing that was noticeable was the wards were quiet. They weren't chasing the nurse or the Red Cross worker. They weren't making jokes. They weren't playing cards. The radios were not on very loud. And the third thing that was noticeable was that they were all by themselves, as much as you could possibly be in a large open ward. They weren't gathered together in groups. When they were given passes to go downtown, they went downtown by themselves. Now, you know, soldiers never go downtown by themselves. But these guys did, the less than one out of five who accepted the pass to go downtown. And the next thing we noticed was that although they wouldn't talk to one another, they would talk to us almost compulsively. You couldn't stop them once they started. They would talk and talk and talk and say things that we just never expected to hear people say about each other. Not vicious, nasty things. They just simply seemed unable to determine what might be harmful to say about somebody else, and they would talk and talk, but not to each other. To the doctor, the nurse, the intelligence agent, to the corpsman, to anybody except another prisoner of war. Now, this we've never before seen. We know that prisoners of war develop intense emotional alliances with one another. They survive frequently on the basis of what we call the buddy system. Their alliances often last for many, many years after they're repatriated. They do have some peculiar reactions at first when they're first free. Anybody would. But they get over these fairly rapidly, usually. Not these people. In the last year, I've talked to over 200 ex-prisoners of war. The one consistent thing about them is that some of these attitudes persist, particularly the sense of isolation from other people. Now, this can be done in a calculated, deliberate sort of a way, and this is how. It's only necessary to interfere and corrupt seriously the process of human communication in order to accomplish this. And they set about it in standard classical ways which are being used today in the Communist Party USA, which are used even in the Kremlin, and which involve chiefly informing and a process called self-criticism. You've heard that kids in the communist society are capable of informing upon their parents, and I'm sure you've dismissed this as the kind of accusation we make against people that we think are pretty inhuman. It is, however, within certain limits, an entirely true and entirely feasible kind of a thing. For the simple reason that informing in the communist state is not informing in the democratic society. They're entirely different procedures. In the people's democracy, informing is undertaken as a civic and social responsibility, as an exercise of your responsibility, not to the people in charge, but to the people, period, to your fellows, to your class, of which you are nothing but a fragment. And informing thus undertaken, not viciously undertaken, but informing undertaken for the welfare of the group in the POW camp, informing done on somebody who swiped a turnip and who should have shared it with others, or who took somebody's blanket when it could have been shared, or didn't use the latrine, properly. This kind of informing was promptly and tangibly rewarded. You remember the communist evaluation is that we are opportunistic. We will do things for rewards, particularly material ones. And so they materially rewarded informers, but also they rewarded them with status and approval. And then, and this is really the crux of the success of this procedure, they failed, apparently, to punish the man who was informed upon. Now, they didn't let him escape scot-free. He was taken aside by one of these Chinese instructors, as they were called, the same guys who made the initial welcoming address, a man who spoke not pidgin English, but Columbia University English and the University of Chicago in California English, a young man who'd been here, who'd seen our Cadillacs and big buildings, and who was still a communist, and who was called an instructor, would take the culprit aside and would have a little heart-to-heart chat with him, which struck most prisoners as being kind of a kindergarten-type procedure, because he was exhorted to see the error of his ways, confess that he'd done wrong, recant, assert his determination not to repeat this antisocial behavior in the future. Having done this, he was, at least during the first year of the war, off the hook. No more was asked. Sometimes they asked him to write his self-criticism, his confession. But more usually, he simply had to confess it during what was called a walking conference with a Chinese. Everybody thought this was a very harmless kind of a thing. And it didn't seem to hurt anybody to get informed upon, so nobody got mad enough to beat up or drown the informers, as has been routine in other American prisoner of war camps. The result was that by the end of the first year of the war, as far as we can determine, there was one reliable American informer in every group of about 10 American prisoners, one that we can now name. That's just an awful lot of informers. Some of the prisoners reported that there was one in every squad, and squads were frequently four or five men. The result is what they were after. The result was simply that the soldier began to discover that he couldn't quite be sure about anybody. You can always be sure of a man who hates you. You know where you stand. But when a perfectly nice guy, out of a sense of civic responsibility or a desire for two tailor-made cigarettes, informs upon you, even though you don't get hurt, it begins seriously to disrupt your interpersonal relationships. And this is precisely what happens. Men began to back off from one another into the most superbly built solitary confinement cell that we've ever seen. Not out of steel and concrete, but an emotional solitary confinement cell. The process of self-criticism is really part of the same informing kind of a cultural organization, only it's collectivized and formalized. It's a seminar-type group of 10 or 12 people. And this is done in the Kremlin, actually. It is done in every unit down to platoon size of the Chinese army, as was related to us by the prisoners we got on the front line. Self-criticism is simply a corruption of religious confession. In another sense, it's a corruption of group psychiatric treatment. Each man is required to get up in this small and seemingly harmless group, which after all only consists of other Americans, and discuss his own shortcomings, his failures, particularly his poor attitudes. And every officer in the military service knows that while you can handle all kinds of misbehavior, when it comes to attitudes, there's a limit. But the Chinese handle them in this peculiar and very carefully thought-out way. You confess your own bad attitudes. Having confessed them, again, there's a sense of having expiated your guilt, a sense also of having been accepted by the rest of the group. It's a getting it off your chest sort of thing, which couldn't be more harmless. And, of course, it was perfectly harmless for the first week, because during that week, everybody thought these confessions, which the Chinese so childishly demanded, were very superficial and kind of humorous, and everybody listened, and everybody kind of smiled and took his turn and got up and talked. And then all of a sudden, something very peculiar happened. Something inevitable happened. And that is that men began to notice that the other men were actually listening. And they also began to notice a feeling in themselves of having talked too much. Now, when asked, the soldier would say, I don't know what I talked too much about, but I did feel like I'd talked too much. I'd gone too far. I'd exposed more of myself than I had intended. And this is exactly, of course, what the man had done. Ultimately, you run out of superficial things, and you talk about things which may not on the surface be serious, but which are meaningful to you. And once you begin to do this, you become vulnerable and exposed, and you back off from other people. We see this in group psychotherapy, in the group treatment of patients, unless it's carefully managed and carefully controlled. We see it among women in our culture more often generally in society than we do among men. But in our culture, women handle this better than men. They do exactly what the soldier does when they feel they've gone too far and exposed too much of their own personal business. They simply set about immediately to collect an equivalent amount of intelligence about their listener, and thus the origin of the armed truce. And this is exactly what these 19 and 20-year-old American GIs were doing with each other. They all came back with fabulous amounts of information about other prisoners. But they wouldn't talk to them walking around the compound, and they wouldn't get together with them because, you see, you really just couldn't be sure of these people. One final thing they did to isolate men from one another was, and from their usual sources of emotional support, was control their mail in what must have been the most difficult, most boring job of censorship that was ever undertaken by anybody. As you perhaps know, we delivered large amounts of mail to Pan Munjom for further delivery to the prisoners. The Chinese evidently read each and every piece of mail that was ever given to them for further delivery. Now, we've had written, both in psychiatric and non-professional literature, a good deal about the value of mail to the soldier overseas. Certainly, each of us knows what mail can do to men. We see the infantrymen sometimes, on the receipt of a Dear John letter, become either useless or practically suicidal in his carelessness. We see all kinds of reactions about mail. The Chinese know just how important it is, as well as we do. And so they undertook their censorship in a new and most peculiar kind of a way. Rather than cut anything out of letters, which, of course, is very irritating, as I'm sure you all recall, or black out certain sentences or words, they simply withheld any letter that was, from an emotional and psychological standpoint, the kind that the prisoner really desperately needed. You stop to consider for a moment, he was getting no emotional supports from his daily interpersonal relationships. He was not getting the reassurance that you and I get from communicating with friends. He wasn't certain of himself, of his worth. And of course, this is a typical reaction anyway of being confined. The person who is confined usually has very serious self-doubts after a while, begins to wonder why he survived when his fellows didn't survive. What right he has, so to speak, to represent the others. Volumes have been written about this one phenomenon of captivity. And there's nothing better for this than to get a letter from home, particularly the old-fashioned trite kind that says, we love you, and we're waiting for you, and don't worry about us here at home, everything's all right. And we pray for you every night, just take care of yourself. This kind of mail no prisoner in Korea got to see, as far as we can determine. Nor did he ever get to see a snapshot, if it were sent. But a Dear John letter, if it were sent, he got. Or a divorce notice, if it managed to get mailed, he got. We got notices, the prisoners got notices from collection companies on the Yalu River, sometimes within 4 weeks of the time they were posted in the United States. They particularly liked, and we had one really superb example of the success of this, they particularly liked a letter from a wife that could be really emotionally disturbing. The one case in particular that comes to mind was an Army major who had married rather late in life, in his mid-40s, to a 20-year-old German girl during the occupation of Germany. And she was a really ravishing girl. She was a beautiful person. He was never quite certain of himself in his relationships with women to begin with. He was very devoted to this youngster. He brought her back to the States, of course, and was never quite sure whether she came back because she loved him or whether she married him to get back to the States. He was somewhat insecure, we would say, in psychiatry, about this relationship.
He left her to go to Korea and left her with his family in New York. She wrote him daily, devotedly. He never saw a letter. She never got any of his. After about a year and a half of not knowing, this girl, in desperation, wrote one letter complaining, letting her hair down, and announcing incidentally that she'd met an awfully nice man who said he was an artist in Hollywood and who wanted her to come there to model. And so she was leaving New York. And this soldier told us that up until that point, he behaved like a man, but from that point on, there just really wasn't any point in it. Now, that's not an oversimplified or a contrived example. This is a true case of an American soldier. This is what the communists, in a sense, were attempting to achieve on a somewhat limited scale with everybody. And they did. When we had the soldiers back in Tokyo and the Red Cross came by with all their money, they offered these people the opportunity to call the United States. Not at $5 a minute or $4 or whatever it was from Tokyo then, but free. Call anybody you like. This was part of our whole approach to being a prisoner of war, which was sort of an automatic assumption that having been a prisoner, you were a hero, which is psychologically destructive to the ex-POW, I might add. At any rate, they were given this particular benefit, and more than half of the prisoners who were offered this opportunity flatly refused, didn't want to call home. You didn't have to call your folks or your wife. You could call anybody you wanted, any place, at Red Cross expense. More than half said no. Maybe tomorrow, maybe next week, maybe somebody else would rather use the telephone. But they wouldn't call home. Well, this essentially is brainwashing. This is the attempt to strip individuals of their normal sources of emotional support, which are gotten by most of us in a very simple, elemental kind of way. We get it from our relationships with other people, from what we invest in other people and what they invest in us. It creates a kind of a vacuum when you're isolated, as these people were. And herein lies one explanation for the almost religious devotion to this ideology that is manifest on the part of a great many communists. Into this vacuum must be introduced something. And here, in these camps, they introduced an education, or rather, condensed, intensive sort of education, very much like, in many ways, that which is given in the communist society all over the world. An education which supplants, to some extent, your relationships with human beings, which gives you something to invest in emotionally, to believe in, to draw support from. And the fact that you get your support from it makes it mandatory, of course, that when the line changes out of the Kremlin, you change with it, and you change with a minimum of resistance, as we have commonly seen for the last 10 years. Now, the education that was given these people, I can't possibly begin to describe in this brief period. It was methodologically an excellent one. It used every graduate teaching method we've ever observed. I'd like to remind you that the overall educational level in the United States among men coming into the Army is the first semester of the ninth grade. These people have not been exposed to much in the way of formal education. They were given an education, however, which used for its methods the graduate seminar, the guest speaker, the group discussion, the dramatization of certain principles, the interpretive production of dramatics, such as Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was presented in most camps as the first production of the little theater group, and in which, of course, not only did they play up the racial controversy that existed, but also they painted Simon Legree as being the prototype of all capitalists. They weren't disheartened by the absence of understanding of the average American about his own system. They assumed he knew nothing about it, and they set out to teach him about how it supposedly worked. They compared it often with the things they're trying to teach in the People's Democracy. And to support all this, they gave the one true version of history, the truth being that which is available solely to the ideologically advanced members of the party who dictate. And this truthful version of history included a great many truthful things about us as well as other capitalist imperialist countries. They talked, for example, about the opium wars, which Great Britain fought. Oh, they were only small wars, but they did fight them with some Chinese who had officially refused to buy any more opium. This was, of course, a very long time ago. It was all about 100 years ago. They talked about more recent abuses within the capitalist economic societies. They talked, for example, about the Oklahoma farmers who migrated to the Imperial Valley and worked for a dollar a day. That is, the whole family worked for a dollar a day. Now, that wasn't very long ago. They talked about the sweatshops where clothing is made in New York. They talked about the minimum wage law, which does not apply in certain states in the United States because in those states they have a different point of view. They played up, magnified, distorted, but always began with something that was demonstrable, something that a few of the prisoners knew something about, something they thought they could make political hay with. They taught about the UN. They taught how our Seventh Fleet violated this and how our entry into Korea violated the UN Charter. They talked about Harry Truman and the capitalists supporting him. They had art classes for those who wanted to draw pictures rather than just go to school all the time. Because if you could draw the kind of pictures they liked, they paid you for it. They reprinted your pictures. We found some of them in Crocodile. We got pictures drawn by Americans in communist publications in the United States. Pictures like Harry Truman with bloody, dripping claws gathering up us exploited tools of the Wall Street warmongers and throwing us into the jaws of death in Korea. They encouraged the writing of newspaper articles for camp newspapers, one in particular called Towards Truth and Peace. Particularly if you could write a real good article like the one that read, I wish to express my profound gratitude to the members of the Chinese People's Volunteer Army for having taught me to read and write English, because in the capitalist imperialist community of Pittsburgh, from which I come, only the sons of rich capitalists are allowed to read and write English. Signed, Private John Smith, U.S. Army. Now, when we saw this, we got concerned about John Smith, and we waited for him to come home so we could talk to him about his article, and he admitted freely that he'd written it, and that it couldn't really do any harm, that, well, it wasn't true in a way, but in some ways you could almost think of it as being true. But anyway, people in Pittsburgh knew it wasn't true and it couldn't really hurt anybody. And of course, what John didn't realize was that the 900 million people who get nothing but this approach don't know it's a lie. And the second 900 million, the second third of the world, the third that hasn't yet decided which side it's going to be on, they don't know it's a lie either. And it wasn't just John, it was 100 Johns or several hundred of these people who wrote these articles in a more or less innocent way, because after all, they were paying for such articles. Now, this was the education. It was something that occupied the attention and the emotional energy of a great many men who were not communists and who are not today communists, nor even security risks. It was simply of interest to us for the following reasons. First, we saw the results. The results were briefly this. No American in these community camps, subjected to nothing more than this kind of control, in camps as lightly guarded as with a ratio of one armed guard to 100 soldiers, with no machine gun towers, no searchlights, no complicated electrical barbed wire fences, no vicious Doberman pinchers, out of those men in those camps, more than 4,000, not one American ever escaped from an organized prison camp in Korea, ever, in spite of what you hear on TV. That was a disturbing finding. Our second disturbing finding about the results of this program was the fact that there was never any effective, sustained, organized resistance of any kind. There were sporadic outbreaks of resistance. There was heroic behavior by a great many Americans individually. As a military procedure, almost, or for practical purposes, never. And then we found that people died under this system. You didn't have to put the branding iron on them, and you didn't have to starve them systematically. They were underfed, they were given no medical attention to speak of except the implantation of a piece of contaminated chicken liver under the skin of the chest in case you had any disease, whatever. But you had to volunteer for that. They were given inadequate shelter and poor clothing. But still, the conditions of captivity there were, as far as we can determine, infinitely better than those in Japanese POW camps in World War II, and were better than most of the German POW camps. And yet men died, and they died in large numbers. They died, as a matter of fact, in the ratio of 4 out of every 10 Americans captured died in captivity. 38%, to be absolutely accurate. That is the highest death rate of Americans in any prison camp or in any prison, in any war, any time in our history since the American Revolution. Now, this constitutes a real, genuine problem. This, plus the fact that instead of occupying hundreds of guards, only a few were occupied. And the other hundreds that weren't were down on the 38th parallel, shooting at perfectly innocent American soldiers, which is a very good way to wage a war, you'll have to admit. Now, because of all this, the code was written. This code of conduct that everybody says is, well, only 247 ordinary English words and isn't going to change anybody's behavior, and certainly you people who work with youngsters and see that even by the time you get them, their attitudes are pretty well formed, know this is true. We're sure not going to spout a bunch of fine-sounding principles at people and expect to make perfect military machines out of them. But that isn't at all what the code of conduct was created for, what it has in mind, or what it will accomplish. The code really spells out, point by point, where, in the face of this kind of a personnel management system, we are vulnerable. Now, neither the code nor I attempt to imply that there is some basic defect in Americans. Nor does the code tend to reaffirm what the communists accuse us of in the original document that I read you. However, we know that more than a third of the Americans, by their own admission, under this system and no other duress, either confessed to things that weren't true, communicated or actively collaborated with the enemy, took part in peace campaigns, wrote home to their mothers and their newspapers, begging them to join movements for peace to stop this senseless slaughter of the innocent civilians by the U.S. Air Force, I might add, which is what they always said. Soldiers took part in this under no more duress than this. They did things which, by historical standards of military behavior, were, if not illegal, at least tragic. And so the code points these things out one by one. It says, for example, next please. It says, I will continue to resist if I'm captured. And why? Well, psychologically, the reason for this is the fact that confronted by any source of intense fear or anxiety, all you can do is either run or fight. And if you can't run that minute, you have got to fight if you're to remain integrated emotionally. You have got to resist, even symbolically. And further than that, the resistance against something we consider evil is, and I know this is a terrible word for a psychiatrist to use, is a moral principle, an important moral principle. It has something to do with the perseverance that's taught to a child. It has something to do with a system of values and believing in something. We found some people who resisted, but we're teaching it now, or trying to, or should be, in these terms. Two men here are resisting.
Major Mayer refers to a projected picture of a prison work detail. One man is distracting the guard, while the other deliberately breaks a shovel.
Because heroism is no longer an MGM-type production, there is no such thing. The only kind of effective resistance is a function of the faith and loyalty among individuals. And it has to be undertaken by groups, not by individual heroes. And so it was also with the escape proposition that we're teaching now. You know why people didn't escape in Korea? No escape committees. It's perfectly simple. You can't escape by yourself. There were some heroic attempts. The closest to success that anybody got was an attempt by a young Air Force lieutenant in connection with a 45-year-old beat-up civilian newspaper man. These people almost got out. And it was a tribute to their tremendous devotion to one another that they almost did. Only disease prevented their success. For the rest of the soldiers, they would think about escaping, and somebody would say, we know you're thinking about escaping, and we don't think you ought to do this because they'll take it out on all of us, which may be true. Just like when you drive your tank up to where they're shooting. They're liable to take it out on everybody in that tank if they can hit you. So men didn't escape. No escape committees. It wasn't undertaken as a military operation. It was undertaken as an adventure, and it didn't work. Again, a function of faith, of investing things in other people, of loyalty, which is intense to other human beings, and of a desire to be free. Well, then the code goes on and makes another point. And this one isn't even military. It says, if I'm ever captured by an enemy, I will not accept favors from him. I will not make any promises to him. That's perfectly logical, isn't it? It's not new, certainly. Nothing in the whole code is. This, in fact, is not military any more than any other basically moral principle. And this is that. Because stated in other terms, this is simply the assertion that you cannot compromise with something you think is evil or wrong. And this, of course, is not a military subject. This is taught in childhood, not at age 18. But now we're teaching it at age 18. And remember, these points are in the code because we found a great many men didn't seem to realize they were important. And so men thought they could make a deal. A lieutenant colonel, a graduate of a service academy, told me that he thought that by collaborating with the enemy or giving that appearance, he could so ingratiate himself with them that he could exercise a beneficial influence on behalf of the other prisoners. Now, you can interpret that any way you want, as an excuse, a rationalization, an out-and-out lie, or the truth. Needless to say, regardless of his motivation, it didn't work. He just ended up collaborating and not helping the other prisoners at all. And this mistake in judgment exists when there is an improper or inadequate moral basis for judgment itself. When you think you can make a deal, you're headed for an awful lot of trouble. And of course, 50 years ago, they'd have said you can't make a deal with the devil. And we don't like to think of the communists in terms of demonology or devils. But we do think they're wrong. You can't make a deal with this either. Then there's the point in the code about keeping faith with fellow prisoners. Now, isn't that a little obvious? Does anybody have to tell any old soldier in this room that he's supposed to keep faith with other Americans? That he's not supposed to do anything to hurt them? Do you know why that point is in the code? Remember that 38% who died? They died in many, many cases because nobody kept faith with them in an active way. People cared, sure. But if a man was too sick to eat, oftentimes, nobody bothered to feed him. Or then there was the case of Sergeant Gallagher, who threw a couple of sick men out of the hut because they were smelling up the hut. They had dysentery very badly. And, of course, we know that this exhortation in the code isn't going to change Sergeant Gallagher a bit. He was a bully. He threw those fellows out of the hut when it was 30 degrees below zero, and they died in about an hour. And so he was convicted of murder here in New York about a year ago. But this isn't what the code was built for. It was built for the other 40 men who stood there and watched Gallagher throw these people out of the hut. The men who, when we said, "Soldier, what were you doing when he threw them out?" They'd say, "Well, sir, I was trying to keep warm like everybody else. The only way you could keep warm was 40 men all bundled together." "Oh, well, you knew it was cold then." "Yes, sir." "And didn't you think maybe it would hurt these guys to get thrown out in the snow when they were sick?" "Well, sure." "So what did you do about it?" "Well, nothing, sir." "And why not, soldier?" we would say. "Well, because, sir, it wasn't any of my business." And so men died because it wasn't any of other Americans' business. So there's a point in the code about keeping faith with other American soldiers. And this really doesn't have anything to do with communist captivity or anything more strange than flying an airplane from here to New York, where three or four people have to cooperate or it won't fly. Next point in the code says something about leadership, about the kind of leadership we're seeing and having trouble with today. We saw a lot of new kinds of leadership in Korea. You see it today, I think, many places. I have word from the best possible authority in many industries that this is one of their problems today. Leadership is being undertaken on the basis of personal popularity, on the basis of exhortation, or on the basis of seduction. of making a deal, of offering rewards. How, in fact, do we recruit? Well, of course, it's unrealistic to say that you can't get people without offering certain kinds of rewards. But aren't we getting awfully materialistic? We found that this leadership by popularity, this unwillingness really to lead on the basis of competence and on the basis of a fundamental understanding of the absolute requirement for organization and for somebody who's willing to assume the responsibility of leadership and for a group of men who are willing to respond to this and support it. We didn't find it in Korea. One out of every 20 men had to be segregated for these tendencies. One out of 20. The other 19 were apparently no problem. And so here in one brief sentence in the Code of Conduct where it says to you, a soldier, a man who grew up as a member of a team, a man who voluntarily joins, where it finds it necessary to say to you now, soldier, if you're ever captured and you're the senior man, take command. And if you're not the senior man, support and back up the man who is. And we thought they learned this in hardware stores and in the A&P because the assistant manager takes over when the manager isn't there. And the alternate captain or the next man in line takes over on the football team when he isn't there. But apparently not. Apparently we need some work in this particular field. Then there's a point in the Code of Conduct about name, rank, service number, and I know this is a subject for at least 2 hours discussion. The reason this predominates in the code, rather than trying to make a qualifying statement and trying to say, now that is, unless they start torturing you or something like that. The reason this is in the code is because for the vast majority of prisoners, it's the only adequate defense they've got. When we teach our intelligence agents to interrogate prisoners, we teach them, if you're screening, find the man who's anxious. And how do you find him? Because the man who's anxious talks to you. He's got to talk to you. And you can utilize his anxiety to make him produce anything you want sooner or later. And this, of course, the communists know just as well as we do. And so the man who volunteered anything about politics, religion, his girlfriend, his attitudes about the war, a weapon that he thought they already knew about anyway, that it wouldn't do any harm, no matter what he talked about, it was entirely unimportant. The mere fact that he talked marked that man forever and ever in communist eyes. And he was the man they never let alone. They never let him up. And so for the great majority of people who are ever prisoners or in a captive society, to communicate with the enemy deliberately for whatever reason is the most serious trap you can fall into.
Obviously, now, if they take you and put you in a solitary cell in Manchuria, don't talk to you for 3 months, feed you nothing but seaweed soup and then start paring on your extremities, name, rank, service number isn't going to do you any good at all. And so if we can, in the future, we will try to predict the men most liable to be exploited. And these deserve even more adequate, more detailed preparation, if there is such a thing for torture. But not for the majority. And then finally the code says you won't do anything or say anything to hurt the United States of America. Isn't it peculiar? Didn't we swear an oath not to do anything to hurt the United States of America, in effect?
And yet a lot of Americans said to us when they came home, I thought my responsibilities were over when I was a prisoner. Where did that idea get started? And it was demonstrated over and over again in the camps that men rejected the concept of personal responsibility. Once they were taken a prisoner, you see, all they were supposed to do is wait. And so people died, and people collaborated, and people failed to get out of the camps, and the communists were able to use only a minimum of their logistical and personnel strength to control this supposedly recalcitrant group of 7,000 American soldiers. So this is why there's a code of conduct. And these are the reasons that somehow don't get printed. The reason nobody seems to think about. And yet, if you stop to think about them, you're seeing the basis for these things in some of the attitudes with which men come into the service. You are preparing, what was it Dr. Wright said this morning? What percentage of all Air Force officers are ROTC people? Where do they get their attitudes? Partly from us. Largely, of course, from the civilian institution, meaning the institution of the home, so-called, the church, the elementary school. Possibly one of the most important jobs facing each of us in the military service is the job of communicating about this kind of value and its actual value for those who are going to have to serve this country. And so this is that moral fiber that we heard talked about before. Because I don't care how big our bombs get or how good our missiles, we are never going to come up with an ultimate weapon that's going to beat anybody if they manage to succeed in capturing enough people's minds. And that's exactly what they're trying to do. It's going on in your school, and I'm not witch hunting. It's going on in attitudes toward authority and toward personal responsibility, in the cynicism and the sophistication which regard individual loyalties as really kind of childish, which regard patriotism as an outmoded, outworn preliminary to that evil thing called nationalism which gives rise to things like Hitler. These are values which have gone a long way in creating this society. We built the barns in this country by people voluntarily joining groups under some kind of leadership and putting up barns for people. And this needs some revitalization. And Korea was a magnificent demonstration. Not of the fact that we're going to pot, we're not. Or the fact that this generation of American youth is any worse than any other generation, they're not. But a demonstration of the fact that face to face with this dedicated and sincere and devoted and thoughtful enemy, at this particular position in history, what our strengths were, they still are, but they need much reinforcement, much reiteration. Now, the junior officers that come from you to us in the active service, out of the ROTC, are the ones who either are going to or are not going to communicate to their men and their NCOs about the principles involved in the code of conduct. Not the code itself, but the principles. And so this, in a very real sense, is one of our primary missions. It's part of this whole business of discipline. But discipline based not on arbitrary authority and not on punishment, but discipline based upon a value system, upon being committed to a set of standards. Dr. Harold Wolf at Cornell has made some very interesting studies of individuals held in individual captivity in the communist state. And he finds that those who are apparently most vulnerable are those who have not committed themselves to a value system. Those who don't believe in something. Psychiatrists are not notably religionists, and I don't intend to give a sermon of any kind. And yet some moral reawakening is necessary, and it has to be an active process, because systems of values, which are what we call character, is never gained by osmosis or by some other magical maturation process. It's taught. It's not too late to teach them when they're in college. It's not even too late when they're in the service. We need a lot of help from outside, but we're going to have to do a great deal of it ourselves. I think the best summing up that I can do, like most speakers, I'll borrow and quote General Lemuel C. Shepard, who was then Commandant of the Marine Corps at the end of the Korea War, who was exposed to this mass of data, which I've admittedly just skipped over the surface of, who became as concerned, and I know this firsthand, about the problems and the implications relative to character development and attitudes toward the country and attitudes toward leadership, and who, when forced to sum up what we can do about it, was forced into the same generalizations that make any consideration of this sound dangerously old-fashioned and trite, but who said it very well when he said this. In the struggle against communism, the war is no longer over when men are forced to yield. The prisoner of war stockade is only an extension of the battlefield, where they must be taught to carry on an unequal struggle with the only weapons remaining to them, faith and courage. And gentlemen, we don't issue those weapons in any military supply room on earth. The problem will not be solved by magic formula. The only approach lies in an awakening of the consciousness of the nation and of the individual to the need for a sense of conviction and dedication to our principles and our cause, which exceeds that shown by our very dedicated enemy toward his own. I thank you.